Okay, so now we are going to have a little bit of a look at how the metta practice is described in the suttas. There isn't that much information about it in the suttas. It seems to be a fairly kind of natural practice that kind of just emerges from kindness in a sense. But we'll have a look at to see how this works. So we have been looking at how to overcome anger, and then a kind of natural continuation of that is to move on to the metta. The word metta in Pali, it is not how to translate that word is not necessarily all that obvious. It means it can be translated a number of ways, like goodwill or well-wishing or friendliness or kindness even. And loving kindness is another one. It does not mean love in the ordinary sense of the word, love in the sense of romantic love or anything like that. It's a kind of non-attached love, which is kind of universal, goes to everyone here. But the word is related to the Pali word mitta. Mitta is the same word you have in kalyana mitta, same word, which means a good friend, right? Metta is the same, comes from the same basic meaning here. So it means like friendliness or loving kindness or something like that. So that is the basic idea of this. So the first sutta we're going to have a look at is just a basic one about how metta is practiced in ordinary life. And this is one of the things I was talking about yesterday, that metta really begins with our ordinary actions and our ordinary speech. And then it kind of develops from there. This is the foundation for it. And this is where it is built up. So this is an extract from the Kosambya Sutta, found in the Majjhima Nikaya, number 48. And this is what the Buddha has to say about this. Then the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, there are these six principles of cordiality that create love and respect and conduce to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. What are these six? Right, so one of the things that you see straight away is that when you have this metta and you have these other factors that are listed here, it creates cohesion, it creates non-dispute, concord and unity. So in any community where you have these things, it creates a kind of good community with a good atmosphere and people live in harmony together. And this is so important. If you're going to have a success in your meditation practice, the idea of harmony and cohesion and living together is so fundamental to being able to do your meditation practice. If there's dispute in the community, if there's lack of harmony, it creates a negative kind of feeling, which makes meditation very difficult. So it's one of the, elsewhere in the sutta, said to be one of the foundation stones for proper success in meditation, living in a harmonious community. And it's great, of course, you know, in communities like the Buddhist Society here, WA, and all of these things, it's important to have a sense of harmony. Then we're kind of moving along together in an easy, nice way without too much friction. There's always going to be some friction, but at least we can minimize it by following these principles. Okay. What are these six? Here, a bhikkhu maintains bodily acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, towards his companions in the holy life. This is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect, conduces to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. Right? So bodily acts of loving kindness. You show your loving kindness or your metta through your actions. You act to the benefit of other people with kindness. And you do it both in public and in private. There's a sense of integrity in your practice. You don't do it for the wrong reasons. You do it really because you want to be friendly, not just because you want to put on a show or whatever. But it is an integrity, something you carry on throughout your day, whether you are in private. This might mean in private with a person, or it might just mean completely in private on your own, right? Even then, you have a sense of metta when you're just by yourself towards your companions in the holy life. These are the sat brahmacharya, and this refers to the in the monastic life, your co-nuns and monks. So this is really meant towards the monastic community, but of course, in principle, it is applicable everywhere. So, but here the Buddha is talking to the monastic community. Again, a bhikkhu maintains verbal acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, towards his companions in the holy life. This too is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect and conduces to unity. And I think very important. We often affect each other so dramatically with how we speak to each other. And we can hurt each other or we can support each other. So the effects are so strong. And sometimes we know that when other people talk to us, then we know how powerful the effects can be sometimes. We should then reflect when that happens, how our speech also affects other people in the same way. So you go back, you have a look at how the Buddha defines right speech in the suttas, and speech that leads to harmony, right? You don't divide people. Speech that is truthful, etc. And of course, speech that is kind of gentle, right? And that is valuable, not just idle chatter, that sort of stuff, but has a certain value to it. So speech, loving kindness, but this is quite difficult, of course, because we often have to talk a lot, so it can be hard to do that, especially if you're in a bad mood, right? And the stuff that comes out may not be 100% loving kindness, but at least we try our best. Okay. Again, the bhikkhu maintains mental acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, towards his companions in the holy life. This too is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect and conduces to unity. So this is where more like the meditation comes in. But of course, it also means that you think well about the people around you. It's not just an act, it is the real deal, right? It's coming from the heart. So you actually, even in private, when you're just by yourself, just inside your own mind, you kind of have this positive view of the people around you. And if you can't have loving kindness, well, at least you can have compassion towards the people around you. And sometimes we give off this vibe, right? Sometimes you can feel people's emotions when they enter the room or whatever. They can be very positive and uplifting, or it can be kind of more dark, right? So it's not just a matter of these things are never entirely private. They also kind of, it's almost like they seep out of us and into the environment around us as well. So these things are important. And then, so that is really ordinary metta in daily life and how we practice that. And then there are three other factors which I might just touch upon very briefly as well, which I mentioned here, that also conduce to this cohesion and harmony. Very obvious things, in a sense, standard things from the suttas, but let's just have a quick look at them. Again, a bhikkhu uses things in common with his virtuous companions in the holy life without making reservations. He shares with them any gain of a kind that accords with the Dhamma and has been obtained in a way that accords with the Dhamma, including even the contents of his bowl. This too is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect and conduces to unity. So this is the idea of sharing, right? That is one of the ways that, one of the most powerful ways you can kind of express your kindness to others is by sharing with them. And as it says here, even the contents of your alms bowl, you share with others. And there are places in the suttas where the Buddha says that if you knew, as I do, the power of generosity, you would never have a single meal without sharing some of the food with somebody else. So powerful is generosity. You take every opportunity, right, that you have to help and to share with others. And so it's almost like we just have to keep remembering these things. And when we remember, then we have the opportunity. But sometimes you forget. And also here you have again this idea that it has been obtained in accordance with Dhamma, right? These are things that are truly yours. They have been obtained in a good way. And when you share things, it is much more powerful when it is shared, that those things you have that actually are really, really yours, obtained in a good way, as we were talking about the other day here. Okay. And of course you share useful things, things that accord with the Dhamma. They actually are things that are allowable. You don't share kind of dodgy things with your co-monastics. Okay, here is this contraband underground article, right? So you share the good stuff. And it's the same thing in lay life. We share things with each other that are useful for each other, that actually lift people up, and not stuff that is kind of detrimental. Okay. Again, a bhikkhu dwells both in public and in private, possessing in common with his companions in the holy life those virtues that are unbroken, untorn, unblotched, unmottled, liberated, liberating, commended by the wise, not misapprehended, and conducive to samadhi. This too is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect and conduces to unity here. And this idea that when you live together and everybody is kind of on the same page, everybody is practicing virtue together, then it is easy to live with people like that. There are very few problems in such a community. All of these things are very high standards, right? This is a very high standard of virtue that is mentioned here. So this is when it becomes really, when you have a kind of ideal, almost like an ideal community with a sense of working together here. And then the last one is about having right view, which is also very interesting. Again, a bhikkhu dwells in public and in private, possessing in common with his companions in the holy life that view that is noble and emancipating, and leads one who practices in accordance with it to the complete ending of suffering. This too is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect and conduces to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. So this view here is obviously the view of a stream enterer or somebody who is on the path to stream entry. So that, of course, people like that would be very easy to live with. But also I think it is a general truth that usually it is easier to live with people who have roughly the same outlook that you have, right? It can be hard to live with people who look at things very differently. And that's why we tend to congregate according to our views. And that's just the way I think it has to be, and it maybe should be like that. It doesn't mean that we should close ourselves off to other people's views. It's just too difficult sometimes to live with people who think in the kind of diametrically opposed ways to how we think. So this natural thing that we have roughly the same views. So, you know, when you become like, when you ordain at Bodhinyana Monastery, it's because you have roughly the same ideas. You kind of take Ajahn Brahm as your teacher, and if you disagree completely with Ajahn Brahm, well, probably better to ordain somewhere else, right? It makes life too difficult otherwise. And the same thing in the in most spheres of life, you tend to hang out with people who think in roughly the same way here. But at the same time, of course, being keeping an open mind at the same time is, of course, important as well. So there's always a balance with these things. Anyway, so there you are. These things that create unity and concord. And the three first ones there, all about metta practice. So now I'm going to have a look at another sutta. This is the simile of the soul that somebody mentioned in one of the questions a few days ago, the Kakkachupama Sutta. And a very famous sutta, and it has some nice similes in here, a little bit about the practice of metta, and also some nice similes about how, what it means to practice this to its fullest extent, and how that actually, what kind of person you become as a consequence. Sometimes I find just reading these things can be quite inspiring in its own right, just to have a look at these kind of advanced stages of practice, so to speak. Because there are these five courses of speech, these five ways of speaking, if you like, that others may use when they address you. Their speech may be timely or untimely, true or untrue, gentle or harsh, connected with good or with harm, spoken with a mind of loving kindness or with inner hate. Right? So people may speak in these five ways, and we know that that's true. And of course, again, it is not just others. We should also kind of look out for these things as a useful way of thinking about one's speech, timely or untimely. There is often a right time to speak and a right time to remain quiet. The time, of course, is the time when the speak will be effective, right? We know that this is the right time because it will have some kind of effect. It will be useful at this time. And the wrong time is when it's not going to be very effective. The other person is not ready to listen, they are kind of defensive mood or whatever it is. It's kind of untimely. So you have to ask yourself, is it timely or not? And part of that timeliness is also, where are you coming from, right? if you are kind of coming from the wrong place, then that's also untimely. But that is also a separate quality mentioned here. The timeliness is very important, knowing the right time for things in general. True and untrue, right? Very pretty obvious that you speak the truth, gentle and harsh. You speak in a gentle way, even if you have to tell somebody off or you have to kind of correct them or whatever. You try to do that in a gentle way. Often the point is that one of the important things is that people feel that we have their interest at heart if we're going to say something to them. Saying something, correcting somebody, part of that should actually be to have their interest at heart, right? They if they have a problem and they can improve, well, listen, maybe we can do it this way instead. And if you come from gentleness, there's a chance they will listen to you, what you have to say. I think this is really, really important in life, this idea that people should feel that you actually are trying to help them rather than feel that you are just kind of, your own grudges, is kind of your own negativity is coming to the surface and kind of just spilling out of you. It's just your own defilements, really. Then it has very little effect often. Connecting with good and with harm. So you are actually, again, thinking about the other person's well-being when you say these things. Spoken with a mind of loving kindness and not with inner hate. So you again, you have clarity about that. So that's quite a high standard, right? It means that often it is best not to say anything at all. But it's nice to have these kind of standards. It kind of guides us in the how we're supposed to move, how we're supposed to go, where the direction we're supposed to head in here. So then it's repeated one more time. So when others address you in this way, with all those five ways, then you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no bad words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness without inner hate. Right? So when somebody says things to you which are maybe not quite right or whatever, you don't retort, you don't respond back in kind. Okay, you're saying bad things to me, I'm going to say bad things to you. So you don't think like that. Instead, you have a mind of compassion for them, because at that time, if they do something silly which isn't right, probably they have some suffering, they have a problem, they have, whatever it is. It is actually always a good time to be compassionate for the other person if they are acting in an unsuitable way. So it's just a matter of perception, of attention, attending in the right way, and then you can have compassion. It's amazing what a slight shift in perception, a slight shift in attention can do to the state of mind you have on these occasions. And we can move it from responding in a bad way to actually being compassionate. It isn't that difficult to do. It just takes a little bit of training, a little bit of a willingness to kind of deal with these issues. So you do that, and then, of course, because you have compassionate, etc., then you can move on from there. We shall abide pervading that person with a mind imbued with loving kindness, and starting with him, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, without ill will. That is how you should train, bhikkhus. So you start, in this case, you have compassion for that person, and here you start with that person doing your metta practice. This is one of the few places in the suttas that mentions how we should start the metta of the loving kindness. And here we start with a person who might be difficult. It's interesting. Why do we start with the most difficult persons? Sometimes we are told that we should start with the easy people, right? The people we already respect and kind of put the hard cases on the back burner for now, and we kind of can get back to them later on. There is something to be said for that, of course. But once you're kind of developing the path in a certain direction, and you don't really have many enemies anymore, right? You put that kind of idea of enemyship behind you, and you're generally friendly to most people. In that situation, any kind of negativity you might have towards certain individuals or whatever, that is going to block your general ability to have metta to everywhere, right? The all-encompassing world, all directions. metta everywhere, that person is going to be, that perception about that person is going to be the hindrance. And that's why you start with that person rather than starting with anywhere else. And once that person kind of, you get that person out of the way, then it becomes easy to kind of spread it out to everywhere and to all beings. Maybe easy is a bit of an exaggeration, but it's a, it's easier, right, to kind of get the obstacles out of the way. So it's not, none of these things are exactly easy, but they are not hard either. They're just matters of development. That's what they really are. And another thing which is interesting about this, sometimes we are told, and this all comes from the interpretation of the Visuddhimagga. Visuddhimagga is a kind of main commentarial work of the Theravada tradition. And it says in there that you should start with yourself in your meditation practice. You have metta for yourself first of all, and then you should spread it out to others. That is kind of the standard way that metta is taught in the in Theravada Buddhism. But here it actually says, no, here actually starts with another person, not with yourself. And it starts with the person who is difficult. Get them out of the way, and then you spread the metta to the whole world. So which is interesting. There is very little evidence in the sutta that you should start with yourself. It seems to be something that is peculiar to the Visuddhimagga. It is actually based on a particular phrase in the suttas, but there was an interesting study done recently by a monk who I know quite well, Venerable Anālaya, who does all kinds of papers on Buddhism, and he wrote a paper on metta practice, and he was looking at this particular word. There's one word, sabbatthaya, which is in the formula for spreading love and kindness, and he looked at the different versions of that word, and he compared it to other languages like Sanskrit and Chinese, etc. And that word is the word that is the Visuddhimagga relies on for its interpretation of spreading to all as to one, or to all as to oneself. But he argues, and I think quite persuasively, that is actually not, that's actually a misinterpretation, a misunderstanding. Interesting. Anyway, it probably doesn't matter so much. The point here is not to say that one way is right and one way is wrong or whatever. It's just really to, whatever works is always going to be right. So if it works for you, it's fine. But I always feel a little bit strange about starting off with metta to oneself. It almost feels kind of a little bit self-centered perhaps, a little bit kind of, okay, I'm going to look out for myself. And I mean, of course, if you have a lot of problems with yourself, maybe that can be a good idea. But generally speaking, if you're spreading metta to the whole world, you are part of the world, you are already included here. You don't really have to single yourself out as some kind of special entity here, I think. But again, in the end, it is whatever works, and if it works for you, then that is fine. I just thought I'd bring that up as a point of interest. So you have loving kindness. You start with that person towards whom there might be some little bit of problems, and then you pervade the all-encompassing world, right? With a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant. You fill it up. It's abundant. It's not kind of just a little bit. You really go for the full, all the way, right? Max out on loving kindness. Exalted, right? The Mahagata, Mahavirachita, the mind which has gone great. Immeasurable, appamana. Pamana means like a limit or a measure, something which is kind of limited. So it means like without limit, without boundaries, without kind of, there's no measure, there's no kind of, it's not like, okay, I'm going to have metta to all of these, but these ones over here, they are outside of my metta. Everybody is included, right? Boundless metta practice is what is meant by this. So it is very high, very kind of lofty emotion, which includes everybody, absolutely everybody, without hostility and without ill will. So they're completely devoid of those qualities. They're completely gone. You can't even see the hindrances. Hindrances are kind of miles away. No ill will at all. So, of course, if you train to that extent, it also means that the ill will is very deeply abandoned. I don't like the word suppressed, because it's not really a matter of suppression. It's just that you have developed your mind in such a way that those things are abandoned for a long time. They can't really come back because your mind is so full of these qualities. So they are really kind of left behind completely in a very thorough way. And if you keep on practicing that loving kindness, you will not have that ill will, right? That will be gone completely from your mind. That is the highest expression of loving kindness, that it is impossible for you to have any ill will. So that is how profound it can go. That is how you should train bhikkhus. But not only does it overcome ill will, if you do the metta practice properly, it overcomes all the defilements of the mind. You also don't have any sensual desires because you have a much higher happiness in your meditation practice. You don't have any sloth and torpor, right? It's completely gone. If you have a lot of metta, your mind is very clear, very strong. Don't have any restlessness. You're perfectly happy where you are. And you know what states are wholesome. You know this is a wholesome quality. The doubt is also gone at that particular point. So it actually affects all the defilements of the mind, not just the hostility and ill will, but the two things that it suppresses, or not suppresses, I just said I shouldn't use that word, but the two things that it abandons the most profoundly and deeply is, of course, ill will. And if you get into a deep state of metta, it won't come back, you know, for a long, long time afterwards, the ill will. So there you are. That is the idea of metta practice, how it is usually explained in the suttas. And now we come to some similes, and similes that shows us what happens when the mind is developed in this way here. Because suppose a man came with a hoe and a basket and said, I shall make this great earth to be without earth. He would dig here and there, strew the soil here and there, spit here and there, and urinate here and there, saying, be without earth, be without earth. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Would that man make this great earth to be without earth? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because this great earth is deep and immeasurable. It is not easy to make it to be without earth. Eventually the man would reap only weariness and disappointment. So too, because there are these five courses of speech and the whole paragraph is repeated. It's almost comical, right? It's like I like the understatement at the end that it is not easy to make this earth to be without earth. It's kind of typical of the Buddha. Things are often very understated very often. But so the point here is that, I also like the earthiness of these things. I mean, we're talking about the earth, of course, but there's a general earthiness of the whole thing. You know, you spit here and there and you urinate here and there. It's kind of very, very down to earth. So the idea here is that you have developed your mind, right, in such a way that your mind becomes like the earth, essentially. That's the idea. And that idea is used elsewhere as well, that you have a mind like the earth. And if somebody comes and kind of digs into you a little bit by saying bad things or doing bad things or thinking bad thoughts, then it's a bit like trying to dig away the whole, dig away, coming with a spade and trying to dig away all the earth, right? Which is obviously absolutely impossible. So the point is that you cannot aggravate anyone, you cannot actually cause any kind of mental change in somebody if they have developed metta to the maximum. They are immune to your little, to whatever you say and whatever you do, they're completely immune to that. And they will always have metta and compassion in response to whatever you say, whatever you do. This is kind of the idea. You have developed your mind like the great earth. And even if people come and they kind of urinate on you, right? It's like the simile here for kind of saying and doing bad things. It doesn't actually affect you anymore. You are beyond being affected by such things. It's fairly straightforward, but it shows you how, obviously very strong, it shows you how powerful this is, right? The kind of similes here are, really strong similes. Let's have a look at the next one here. Because suppose a man came with crimson, turmeric, indigo, or carmine and said, these are all colors, right? And said, I shall draw pictures and make pictures appear on empty space. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Could that man draw pictures and make pictures appear on empty space? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because empty space is formless and invisible. It is not easy to draw pictures there or make pictures appear there. Eventually that man would reap only weariness and disappointment. So too, because there are these five courses of speech, etc., that was spoken about just before. And again, it's kind of comical, this person come and say, I'm going to draw pictures in empty space. And it kind of drives home the point. It is so comical. In the same way, just as comical as it is, if you think you're going to make somebody angry or upset somebody who has developed loving kindness to the limit, right? Just as silly an idea that you're going to have any effect on them. And here, I like this idea here of space being formless. It says here, non-manifestive. The word is anidasana. It means non-manifestive, perhaps invisible. It's based on the word dasana, which means to see. Prefix ni, ah, which is a negative. So it's something like invisible, or non-manifestive. Non-manifestive is a bit of a... It's a bit kind of... you wonder exactly what it means, but... invisible is more obvious what that means. And the idea here, in a sense, is that when you come to somebody who has developed metta to the maximum, they are almost in the same way. They are almost empty inside, right? There's no sense of self there anymore. There's nothing that you can really touch with your bad speech or your bad actions. That sense of emptiness, that sense of nobody being home, really. And when nobody is there and nobody is at home, it's not you haven't given up the sense of self completely, but there's very, very, very little left. And what is there is very pure. There's nothing you can really touch. There's nothing that you can actually aggravate, nothing you can stir up, nothing you can do anything with. So again, it's the same kind of problem. You are. There's no way that such a person will be affected by anything here. Empty space, right? You are kind of got this formless, invisible personality, empty sunyata. You're empty inside, and nobody can come and draw pictures on you, make you upset or whatever. Because suppose a man came with a blazing grass torch and said, I shall heat up and burn away the river Ganges with this blazing grass torch. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Could that man heat up and burn away the river Ganges with that blazing grass torch? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because the river Ganges is deep and immense. It is not easy to heat it up and burn it away with a blazing grass torch. Eventually the man would reap only weariness and disappointment. I shall burn away the river Ganges with this blazing grass torch. Again, you know, it's kind of outrageous, right, when anybody would say such a thing. I don't know if you have seen the river Ganges. I have seen it. When you go to India, you cross the river Ganges at Patna. I think it's called the Mahatma Gandhi Bridge. Or no, I'm not sure. Anyway, it doesn't matter. There's a big bridge, enormous bridge that goes over there, and you kind of on this bridge, it goes on and on and on, right? It's 3 kilometers long or something, and then eventually reach the other side. Depending on what time of the year it is, there will be lots of water or not so much water, but it is an enormous river, one of the biggest rivers in the world. I think the point here is just to show how silly this is, right? It's just a completely ridiculous idea. In the same way, so the blazing grass torch is kind of somebody else's anger, perhaps, or somebody else's bad conduct, right? And it is not going to affect you. It's hardly going to affect you at all. You can maybe, you know, burn away a few drops of water, but that's about it, and the rest will just keep on going. You are remain unaffected because you are deep and immense, right? Like the river Ganges, the mind is like deep and immense. There's no superficial aspects of speech and actions are not going to have an effect on that kind of mind. So, the next simile here. Bhikkhu, suppose there were a catskin bag that was rubbed, well rubbed, thoroughly well rubbed, soft, silky, rid of rustling, rid of crackling, and a man came with a stick or a potsherd, and he said, there is this catskin bag that is rubbed, etc., rid of rustling, rid of crackling. I shall make it rustle and crackle. What do you think, Bhikkhu? Would that man make it rustle or crackle with the stick or the potsherd? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because that catskin bag being rubbed, etc., rid of crackling, rid of rustling, is not easy to make it rustle and crackle with the stick or the potsherd. Eventually the man would reap only weariness and disappointment. So I don't know if there are many catskin bags around these days. It seems like some kind of ancient thing they had that time in India. But you get the idea. The idea is that all the flaws have been taken out of that catskin bag, right? All the flaws are gone, rid of imperfections. Just like the mind in samadhi. When you read the standard formulas for samadhi and you start to do the inside practices, one of the things that is vigata upakilesa, the imperfections of the mind have gone. And in the same way, the imperfections of this catskin bag have been completely undone. They are not there anymore. There is no imperfections. And because there are no imperfections, you cannot make it rustle or crackle with a stick or a potsherd. It's a bit hard to really know exactly what is going on here, but you get the rough idea, right? There are no defilements that you can poke with a stick. When you poke people, usually with a stick, right, you're kind of testing them out, usually you get a reaction back. Here, there is no, you can poke and poke, no reaction, right? They just have metta and kindness for you. So, I think the idea is fairly clear. And now, we come to the simile for which this whole sutta is named after, the simile of the saw, the Kakuchupama Sutta, the simile of the saw. Because even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handled saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hate towards them, would not be carrying out my teaching. Here in Bhikkhus, you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected. We shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness without inner hate. We shall abide pervading them with a mind imbued with loving kindness and starting with them. We shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. That is how you should train bhikkhus. Right? And this is one of those similes that is very strong and it kind of drives home the point, right? To the extent to which one should never get upset or angry with anything. This is like almost the worst thing that probably somebody could do to you, right? They come along and they just grab you and they tie you down, right? And then they take out a two-handled saw and they start cutting you up piece by piece. So how are you going to react if that happens? Are you going to have loving kindness towards them? Or are you going to kind of react in a different way to these people? And this, it sounds almost impossible, right? How can you have loving kindness to people like this? How can you see their good qualities? How can you have compassion for them? It is one of those things that when you see this, you think, whoa, the Buddha is asking too much. This is just impossible. But of course, the point is, it is not impossible. And that is the whole point. That is the whole point of the sutta. Once you have developed that metta to the maximum, then it is impossible to touch you anymore. It doesn't matter what people do to you. It becomes kind of irrelevant. If you have a lot of metta, yes, you still feel the pain in the body. But you know, it is just a pain in the body. And soon enough, it will be gone, right? If they really cut you up into pieces, you're going to be dead before you know it. And then you're dead and you're out of here. Like yesterday, dying is actually not so bad. You get rid of that body and you kind of get freed from that. Okay, big deal. Actually, dying itself is not really the issue. The issue is much more how we live our life right now. And if you live with metta in this way, you're going to move on in a very beautiful direction afterwards. And this also shows you some of the things I was talking about before, about how we change our direction, where we are, what we are emphasizing, what we are looking at, right? So the reason you get upset is because you think about yourself, right? Oh no, I'm suffering. These are doing bad things towards me. But here our attention is on them instead. And you're able, even though they hack you to pieces limb by limb, you're able to see actually they have some good qualities in there as well, right? They have some, maybe it's a mistake, maybe they think that you are a bad person and they hack you to pieces. Maybe it's just some it could be so many reasons why these things are happening, and it may have nothing to do with you personally, but it just happens. So you're able to see through that, you're able to see the source, see behind that, and you focus on them, focus on their qualities, their suffering, you have compassion, metta, whatever it is, instead of focusing on you. So in that case, you can deal with any kind of pain, right? You can deal with these things because it is pain can always be dealt with under in the right circumstances. It reminds me of in Norway, in about 150 years ago thereabouts, there was a lot of people who did polar explorations. They would travel to the North Pole and the South Pole, and they would do kind of crazy, absolutely crazy things. And one of the things they did, this was 150 years ago, so equipment, everything was really, really primitive compared to what it is these days. But one of the things that this group of guys did, they would go to Greenland. In those days, Greenland was completely unexplored territory. And they would start on one side of Greenland on skis, and they would go walk on skis across Greenland to the other side. It would take them weeks, right? Because the equipment was very primitive. They had to carry all the supplies with them. There were no helicopters. They didn't have any dogs. Everything was carried with them. So they had these big sleighs that they would pull, and they would walk up several kilometers to get to the top of the ice and trek for 1,000 kilometers across ice and snow. And one of the things that always made an really impact on my mind, I remember, was that some of them would get frostbite, and the frostbite would be really, really bad. So what they would do, literally, they would take the saw out, and they would take the saw and cut off their own limbs, right? Cut off the foot with a saw that they had in the hand. And so I thought, how can anyone do that? How is that possible? And it just shows you that pain can always be dealt with if the situation requires it. Right? Pain is always something you can deal with. And this is the same thing, obviously, in this case. The pain is only a small thing, especially if your mind is well developed. I don't know how these guys on Greenland were able to deal with, because I don't think their minds were all that well developed. But still they were able to deal with it, right? So it's kind of astonishing. Anyway, just a little story there. So that is the... How you do this, you are, and it sounds impossible, right? But the point is that it is not. And it's something to kind of look towards, something to be inspired by, not something to say, oh no, I'm never going to get there, it's too hard. But this is the whole point. It is actually something wonderful that our human mind can be developed in that direction. These are possibilities in each one of us. It's something to uplift you to think that you too, every one of us has the ability to actually go to a place like this. And that should be, I think, a very uplifting and wonderful thought. And all you need to be able to get there is a mind, right? If you haven't got a mind, then you can't do it. But if you have a mind, then you should be okay. And if you haven't got a mind, that means you're a zombie, probably. So if there are any zombies on this retreat, then this is not for you. But otherwise, you should be fine. Okay. Because if you keep this advice on the simile of the saw constantly in mind, do you see any course of speech, trivial or gross, that you could not endure? No, venerable sir. Therefore, because you should keep this advice on the simile of the saw constantly in mind, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Right, so if you keep that simile of the saw in mind, and the simile of the saw was obviously quite famous in those days, because it is quoted also in other suttas. They refer back to this sutta, to the simile of the saw. So it was one of those things that was there to help you, to remind you of how to deal with difficult situations in life. Okay, so that is the Majjhima Nikaya 21, the beautiful sutta on the simile of the saw. There is much more to this sutta as well, about how to endure difficult things, how to be patient, as was pointed out the other day. And all of that is also part of this sutta. It's a nice sutta to read the whole thing, but here I have focused on the aspects that are most relevant to at this particular point. Okay, so then the very last one is just a summarizing again of how the metta meditation, or how the Brahma Viharas, the divine abidings, how they are practiced according to the suttas. And this is from Majjhima Nikaya 7, the simile of the cloth, the Vat Upama Sutta, or another nice sutta. But here I've just taken out the little part which has to do with the Brahma Vihara practice. He abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness, likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above, below, below, around and everywhere, as to all, as to himself, he abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. So here you can see again this idea that you abide pervading the quarters, right, the different directions, the four quarters and up and down and everywhere. And this is the standard way it is shown in the suttas. It doesn't really talk about individuals, but it talks about directions instead. So you build up that mind, first of all, you have it already there available, and then you just spread it out to all directions. Whatever beings may be out there, you just spread it out to all of those. And then it says here, to all as to himself, right? And this is that phrase I was talking about before, sabbatataya, and this is the one which the Visuddhi Magga uses to start off with yourself. That's why the Visuddhi Magga says that. But I now think that the word is not actually to all as to himself, but just another word which means everywhere. It's just a slight spelling difference. And this is one of those strange things when you start reading the suttas. Sometimes a small spelling difference, right? There are many versions of the suttas. You have the Pali suttas, they are found in the version from Sri Lanka. They have a version. You have a version in Burma. You have a version in Thailand. You have a version in Cambodia. You now have a version in India. You have a version which has been made made in England, in the UK, by the Pali Text Society. You have all these different versions. And when you compare those different versions, sometimes there are slight variations. They're not exactly the same, right? This is what scholars do. They kind of read all this and they see tiny differences. And they see one difference and then they write enormous articles on this tiny difference. What does it mean? What is the original one? What did the Buddha actually say, right? And this is how slowly, slowly, the suttas get corrupted. Alternative readings get in there. Things start to change. And you start to wonder, well, what actually was the original word of the Buddha? And so because there was two different ways this word can be read in the Pali Suttas, you have to try to figure out what is the real word. And this was this Venerable Anālayo, this monk I know who is one of the top scholars now in the early Buddhist studies around the world, and he made this very good argument that it actually means like everywhere, all around, right? It's just another word which means just that, instead of meaning to all as to himself. But again, it is not a very important point, but it's kind of interesting because it shows you how things start to deteriorate and change, and before you know it, you have a completely different teaching from the one that was originally taught by the Buddha himself. So, you abide again, pervading the all-encompassing world, exalted, right, immeasurable, without hostility and ill will, exactly the same thing as before. And then, having done that, then you also do it with compassion, right, karuna, altruistic joy, mudita, and then with equanimity. So each one of those, you pervade one quarter with a mind of compassion, with equanimity. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. Above, below, around, everywhere. And instead of to all as to himself, just to the whole world. And he abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with equanimity. Abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. Each one of these is kind of a step forward, a step a little bit higher, right? Loving kindness is like the basic practice. It doesn't mean that it's easy, it just means that it is the basic in this particular scheme of things. And then you move on to compassion afterwards. That was one of those things I was saying yesterday, that loving kindness in the suttas, metta, is always first. Compassion, karuna, is always second, it comes afterwards. So loving kindness is the basic practice, then karuna, because karuna is more closely related to seeing the suffering in the world, and you need a strong foundation in loving kindness, a strong foundation overcoming the defilements before you are ready perhaps to deal with the suffering and have compassion for beings. And then after that comes the altruistic joy, the mudita, which just really means just joy on other people's behalf. And then eventually the equanimity, the mind which is absolutely even, gone beyond, you're so even, you're gone beyond all feelings, feelings that are bad, feelings that are good. All of that has kind of been left behind. None of that remains at this stage. And that is the highest emotion from a Buddhist point of view. And one of the reasons why equanimity is the highest emotion is because you cannot really attach to it very much. There can still perhaps be some attachment to metta, right? You're feeling very nice, feeling very happy. But once you go beyond all of that and you see all of that as a kind of slightly problematic because of that attachment, whatever, and you get to complete upeka, complete equanimity, it's like your mind is very aloof, very withdrawn from all worldly phenomena, and it makes the mind incredibly strong and enables it then to make this the basis for a profound insight, because the mind is so strong and powerful at that stage. So that is the standard way of developing loving kindness in the suttas. And I would recommend you to try out this loving kindness meditation. In practice, you have to you can just do it this way. You can just start, you know, spreading out metta and friendliness and kindness to the directions. You can do that. But you need to have some, obviously, a little bit of metta kindness there already. So you have to have practiced all these other things that we're talking about in daily life, thinking kind thoughts about other people, acting in kind ways, speaking in kind ways. And when those things are really established, then when you sit down, there will already be a sense of kindness there. And then you can spread it out. Another way of doing this, if you find that difficult, because it obviously is not easy, and that is to move more towards the method you find in the places like the Visuddhimagga, which starts often with individuals, with people. Even though the suttas don't really deal with individuals so much, that's what it does in the Visuddhimagga. And then very often what you do is you start with somebody who it is easy to have a sense of metta towards, right? Somebody you respect, somebody you feel have very powerful spiritual qualities. And you start with that, and you build up those qualities in your mind. You see that person that way. You see them with a smile on the face, which shows those good qualities, if you like, there. And then when you see that, and you feel inside of you, wow, this person is really worthy of being kind to. Right? You really want to be kind to this person. And then you wish them well. And then you build up the feeling from that point. This is also one way of doing it. So you build up the feeling. And when you build up the feeling of one person and it starts to kind of bite, then you can start spreading it out into all directions. And then take it out from there. So maybe we can try out a little bit of metta meditation maybe tonight, because it might be good to try these things out in practice and see what happens. But there's no kind of real magic to it. It's just a matter of getting into that mood of the mind. And then when you get into the mood, then things start to go from there. The Brahma Viharas are very highly praised in the suttas. Sometimes when you read the suttas, you see the jhana states, the Samma Samadhi, which is at the end, very end of the Noble Eightfold Path. And sometimes you see the Brahma Viharas also in connection with the jhanas. And the Brahma Viharas are often elevated to something slightly higher position than the jhanas themselves. You have the four jhanas, then the Brahma Viharas, then you have the immaterial attainments after that, right? So they are even considered higher than the jhanas when they are fully developed. And one reason for that is because you are developing this metta to the point where you actually get into a jhana state as well. And because it is a combination of metta, a combination of Brahma Vihara, together with very profound samadhi, that combination makes it something even more powerful at keeping the hindrances at bay and purifying the mind to a very high extent. So these are very wonderful things, very highly praised, and when you develop them to the full, you are getting very, very close to enlightenment, to awakening itself. That is how powerful these states are here. Okay, so that is all for this morning. And this afternoon, we're going to have a look, more of a look again at sensual pleasures and how to deal with that, another very important aspect of the Buddhist path. So we'll see you again at 3:00 this afternoon.